From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, as the Republican-led legislature takes aim at new Governor Tony Evers' power, we look at how Democrats reacted when Scott Walker took office.
Democrats at that time did not try to change other state laws during the lame duck period. They did not do something that is anywhere near as sweeping as what the Republican legislators are looking at right now.
Plus, we'll talk with incoming Milwaukee County Sheriff Ernell Lucas.
Later, why the Green Bay Packers beat the Rush and fired head coach Mike McCarthy with a month left in the season.
Something had to be done. They're 4-7-1. I mean, they're not going anywhere, and you might as well get a head start on the rest of the league.
And a Latin spin on some music for the Hanukkah season, Latke con Salsa.
These Hanukkah tunes have never had it this good before.
Lake Effect is next, after the news.
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Wisconsin legislature's lame duck session has been making national headlines. This past Friday, Wisconsin Republicans made public a number of bills that would limit the power of the newly elected governor and attorney general.
The bills were released at the end of the workday Friday with a public hearing yesterday and a vote scheduled for today. Since then, local and national attention has prompted a lot of discussion both at the State House and around the water cooler.
We reached out to Patrick Marley, who covers the state capitol for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, to unpack this pending legislation. Marley spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers from the State House, and he starts by explaining the bills currently on the floor.
So they've got this pretty sweeping measure that would restrict the powers of the incoming Democratic governor, the incoming Democratic attorney general. It would restrict early voting. It would move the 2020 presidential primary and do a number of things that have got opponents up in arms.
It has a lot of people up in arms, not just here in the state of Wisconsin, but nationally. A lot of people are dubbing this, you know, the Wisconsin power grab. You know, you work with you at least speak with these politicians pretty regularly. What has been their response? Why are they putting these bills forward?
So the Assembly Speaker, Robin Voss, says that there should be a rebalance of the power in the state, that the shared governance between the governor and the legislature, and obviously the judiciary, and that he thinks too much power has been ceded to the governor. He wants to have the legislators have more say in the doings of the state. That's what he said right after the election when he first suggested this idea. We didn't see the actual bill language until late on Friday. So no one has really explained some things like the plans to greatly diminish the powers of the attorney general.
Yeah. So, you know, he says it's trying to rebalance the power. Is this something that was different before Scott Walker came into office? Are these things that are new powers that were given to him?
Some of what they're doing does take back powers they granted to Scott Walker when he first came to office. When he won in 2010, one of the first bills they passed in 2011 did Governor Walker more say over administrative rules, which are rules that implement the details of state laws. This would roll that back and put them into what they were previously. But it would also go further than that and make it easier for the lawmakers to permanently block any rules that Evers were to pass. And it would also put stiff limits on his ability to make any changes whatsoever to programs that are jointly run by the state and federal governments, like, you know, food share or other public benefits programs.
So it's really diminishing his power in a lot of ways.
I think it's important to note that if this passes and it becomes law, you know, the governor of the state of Wisconsin will still have very significant powers. The governor in Wisconsin wields likely the most powerful veto pen in the country. Any fiscal legislation the governor can rewrite wholesale, with very few limits on that power. The lawmakers can't touch that without a constitutional amendment, which requires a vote by the public.
Okay.
That said, the far more significant thing here is what's happening to the attorney general, because that the legislature does appear to have broad leeway in setting what powers the attorney general has, and they're looking at really scaling those back for Josh Call, the Democrat who just won in November.
Yeah, so what would this mean for the attorney general?
The legislators would be able to handpick private attorneys at taxpayer expense to handle any case the attorney general handles now. So they can pick their own attorneys and just basically substitute them for the attorney general when the state is sued for any number of things. And, you know, when, if the law passes and somebody sues over whether that law is constitutional, the lawmakers could push Kroll out of the way and put their own attorneys in place. A group of lawmakers would sign off on any court settlements. So that's everything from environmental cases to, you know, litigation over the conditions at the state's juvenile prison that was recently resolved. There's some other ongoing litigation related to that. The Solicitor General, which is a newly created position that oversees the most complex litigation, that office would be gone. And court settlement money would be in the control of the legislature rather than the Attorney General.
One of the things that I think a lot of people have pointed out as a very unusual thing, considering kind of recent history, the Republicans are looking to hold a separate election, is that right, for a Supreme Court position?
Yes. What they're looking at doing is moving the 2020 presidential primary. So right now in 2020, we'd have a February primary for state Supreme Court and local offices. And then an April election, we have the presidential primary and the state Supreme Court race. Republicans are concerned that there'll be very high Democratic turnout for the 2020 presidential primary, and that that would mean Daniel Kelly, who's the Supreme Court justice who's up for election, would lose. And so to save him in that election, they want to move the presidential primary to March. That way, the high turnout under this theory would be in March of 2020, and then you would see a much smaller turnout in April 2020 for the Supreme Court race. And then they believe that Dan Kelly would have a much better chance of winning that election.
So this is an explicitly partisan move.
Yeah. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, the Republican head of the Senate, said that is the reason for doing this. Some Republicans have made other arguments, like they think it's unusual that there's both a partisan and nonpartisan race on the same ballot, and said that was their rationale. But Fitzgerald was very blunt about saying the reason to do this is to try to keep Daniel Kelly on the Supreme Court. And I mean, I think really any Republican who has spoken candidly about this has said that's the rationale. But their public argument is that they think it's unusual for partisan and nonpartisan offices to be on the same ballot. That's not an argument that has been made after the 2016 presidential primary or other presidential primaries.
I was about to say, I haven't seen that argument before, and I believe that's been the case on a number of different ballots. You know, when we're talking about this, I have to say it sounds as though they're explicitly trying to subvert the efficacy of votes. They're trying to say, well, you know, if the people that we don't like are coming out to vote, if Wisconsinites have a different view than us, then we don't want to hear it.
I mean, you know, the Republican lawmakers are very concerned about the Supreme Court, which now has a conservative majority, becoming a liberal majority. And they've said they think that it's important enough to preserve that, so they want to move the presidential primary. I'd also say that appears to be one of the provisions that got some of the weakest support among the Senate Republicans and is something that possibly could change here in the next day or two.
Okay. You know, right after the election, right after the 2018 election, Republicans said that, you know, Democrats do not have a mandate to lead the state. And they've said, you know, really, they were voted back into office, which is true. But what percentage of the overall vote did Republicans in the state get compared to Democrats in the state? Because I know in 2016, they received fewer votes, but maintained a majority.
Yeah, so I don't have that figure off the top of my head, but the results of the 2018 election are that Tony Evers narrowly won the governorship. Republicans maintained a very large majority in the legislature. The Democrats say the Republican control of the legislature is a function of gerrymandered maps. They say the maps aren't fair, and that's why Republicans have as many seats as they do. The Republicans say no, the reason we have these large majorities is because Democratic voters are concentrated in Milwaukee and Madison, and that because those voters, there are many of them, and so they can affect statewide elections as they did in the U.S. Senate race and the Attorney General race and Governor's race, but legislatively, they're not dispersed around the state, so for legislative races, they don't have as much impact. This is a very hotly contested legal issue. It's in court now over the way those maps were drawn. The results of the 2018 election for the legislature will be sliced and diced by both sides in part of that litigation. At the end of the day, it's the U.S. Supreme Court that's going to decide whether the maps that Republicans drew for themselves in 2011 are constitutional or not. A lower court has found that they are not constitutional. The U.S. Supreme Court said those who brought the case didn't have standing and kicked it back to the lower court. So we'll have a new trial on that in April, and then we'll wind its way back to the Supreme Court.
That's something that's come up with these new bills, that if they're able to override the Attorney General's ability to control these cases, if they're allowed to appoint their own lawyers, they would have a big impact on those cases moving forward.
There is just one case on redistricting that what the court said was that they needed a voter couldn't challenge more than their own district. They couldn't challenge the statewide map. So what that meant was that when the case got refiled, there were some new plaintiffs who might have standing to challenge the entire map, and they got in voters from virtually all districts in the state to challenge their districts so that they could make the case that so many maps need to be changed that the entire statewide map needed to be changed. So there's one lawsuit.
Okay.
And the state assembly has, prior to this bill being introduced, intervened in that case. So it has its own lawyers in that case. So that is going to be a fight that plays out between a group of Democratic voters and other Democrats who brought the lawsuit against Republican lawmakers who have now intervened in the case. That is how that legal battle is going to play out, regardless of what happens in the lame duck session.
Okay, so this session won't have any impact on that.
It doesn't appear to me.
Okay.
Because what happened in that case is that the Republicans were able to intervene in that case just by filing a motion with the court and asking the court to let them in, and the court did allow that. In other litigation, either existing or future litigation, there wouldn't be a question for a judge as to whether to let lawmakers come in. They would just, the law would say they have an automatic right to become part of cases and to put their own attorneys on these cases.
Okay. That's one of the many things. So there's been a big national dialogue about this situation. That's one of the things that's been brought up. Another thing that I saw brought up, you know, there have been arguments that a similar thing happened when Governor Walker took office. Is that accurate?
So Governor Walker won in November of 2010, and in the lame duck period, before he was seated as governor, the Democrats, who controlled all of state government, tried to pass the labor contracts for state workers. They convened, they got it through the assembly, they came up short in the Senate. Two Democratic senators defected and sided with the Republicans and voted the contracts down. So yes, there was a lame duck session, which Republicans were very frustrated by at the time. They didn't think it was fair that just before a new governor was seated, they passed a labor contract that would have cost taxpayers, I don't know what the figure was, but millions of dollars in additional pay. So that is true. Democrats at that time did not try to change other state laws during the lame duck period. They did not do something that is anywhere near as sweeping as what the Republican legislators are looking at right now.
So they weren't trying to limit the power of Governor Walker.
That's correct. They did not do anything to limit the powers of Walker or to limit the powers of the Republican Attorney General at the time. They didn't make changes like that.
Patrick Marley covers the state capitol for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He spoke with Joy Powers. Following our conversation with him, the Wisconsin Elections Commission released vote totals statewide, which showed that in the state Senate, GOP candidates received just over 50% of the vote, but retained around 64% of the seats that were up for election in 2018.
Governor-elect Tony Evers was asked about the lame duck session and the legislation at a media availability on Sunday. This was his response.
We had 2.6 million people in the state of Wisconsin voting in that election and thinking carefully about that vote. And I believe that, and I've heard from many of them, that their concerns are as valid as mine, that this special session bill, it will take us to a place that the people of Wisconsin will feel that their vote has not been counted or valued.
You can find more of our coverage at WUWM.com.
We'll take a short break and then a conversation with another newly elected official, incoming Milwaukee County Sheriff Ernell Lucas. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. David Clark was Milwaukee County's controversial elected sheriff for 15 years. He was recognized nationally for his cowboy hat and his outspoken support of Republican policies, despite winning the office as a registered Democrat.
Clark resigned from the post in 2017 to join a conservative political action committee, and Richard Schmidt took over as acting sheriff. But the position is changing hands again. After winning the election in November, Ernell Lucas will step into the role next month.
The sheriff-elect explains to Lake Effect's Mayon Silver that he's taking inventory of what the department is doing right and what things need a different approach. He says one area of change will be his leadership style.
Well, I'm a one that allows for participation. I want the best and the brightest around me and allow their voices to be heard. Everybody's going to play a role in the future of the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office. And so, again, I'm going to invite those that have ideals, that have some creativity, and certainly that have the desire and commitment to making the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office a better organization to step up and let their voices be heard.
And what are some of the ways that you'll work on law enforcement community relations? Mm-hmm.
Well, besides community engagement, again, the role that Ms. Colas will play is to take our organization and the profession of law enforcement out to the community so that people understand what their role and responsibility is when it comes to encounters with law enforcement, but also what roles we play in this community. And then I'm already starting to meet with the business community, academia, and certainly elected officials both in the city and in the county. And then we have partners at the state level as well as law enforcement and other partners all around the country. So, again, we're going to be working hard to reach across the aisle to provide a hand up to those that are looking for an opportunity to join in the effort to make Milwaukee County strong and safe. And so we're going to be very active in the engagement once we take office.
And what about communities that feel like they're excessively targeted by law enforcement in Milwaukee?
Well, I think I've already started to heal that. They were very supportive of me during the campaign. Many of our immigrant communities and our communities of color really played a strong part in me being elected sheriff. So, again, I've already extended my hand to them. Nothing that I do, nothing that we do will be done without their participation, their knowledge. We can already start to see the trust taking hold, the bridges being built, the partnerships being formed. And again, they're going to play a major role in helping turn around the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office.
And what are some of the concrete things planned in that regard? Anything specific?
Well, again, establishing partnerships, having them come in to the sheriff's office, sit on panels, advisory boards, the like that. Certainly going out to communities, speaking about what their roles is as residents, members of this community, as well as the role that we have. And then inviting them to take us where they go, because, again, if they can now go into neighborhoods and the places where we previously could not go and say that there's a new Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office here and it's one that we can work with, I think that that's some of the concrete steps that we can start taking.
And it seems, I mean, the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Department serves a different role than the Milwaukee City Police Department, but is there going to be communication, and what kind of communication?
Well, that's a good question. That's part of our mission, to go out there and educate people. What is it that the roles are the sheriff's department, of the sheriff's department? Historically, we've had the responsibility for the airports, the courts, the freeways, the jail, and the parks. And moving forward, we're going to still continue to have those responsibilities. But we're going to make clear to the people in this community that, again, these are what our responsibilities and duties are. These are the things that you can help play a part in helping us keep our community safe. But more importantly, we'll reach across over to the Milwaukee Police Department and help them in any kind of way to educate the public as to what their function and their role is in our community and helping make our community safe.
And of those areas, you know, the airport, the lakefront, the parks, the courthouses, are there particular target areas that you're going to be focusing on? Is there a particular area of need?
Well, we've seen violence erupt on our freeway systems here in the past week. We've had some incidents in our courtrooms. And then back during the warmer days, warmer months, we had some incidents in our parks. Listen, no place is immune from time and opportunity happening. But what we've got to ensure is that we're doing our very best to provide the level of service that the people of Milwaukee County truly deserve. And that, again, that we're utilizing the best in technology, the best in training, and certainly equipping our officers the very best we possibly can to go out there to do the job to make our community a better place.
Is there going to be a change in tactics to reduce deputy-involved shootings?
Let me say this. We're going to do everything we can to provide our officers with the training that's needed to do their jobs. You know, law enforcement is a much tougher job today than it ever was when I was a young officer. They're encountering more guns. They're encountering more individuals that might be either under the influence and more individuals that are just disposed to be indifferent to law enforcement. We've got to equip our officers and our deputies to be better prepared to respond to those challenges, employ techniques of de-escalation and other things. But most importantly, I've got to ensure that my people are safe as well. No sheriff, no police chief wants to call a family of a loved one and say that your loved one won't be coming home. So again, we have an awesome responsibility. We have an awesome duty. And those young officers are under a lot more pressure than they ever were in my day. And so we've got to work to give them the best possible tools to be safe and also to keep the public safe.
Former Sheriff Clark came under fire for deaths at the Milwaukee County Jail, as well as allegations of civil rights abuses there. Do you have ideas for dealing with issues at the jail?
Well, again, we're going to start with a perspective that everyone deserves to be treated humanely. Everyone's going to be treated with dignity and respect. We're going to provide personnel in the jail, medical providers that are concerned about the whole individual that comes in with pre-existing conditions where the jail may not be a place for them to be confined. We're also not going to house those persons that have mental health challenges that, again, where jail is not a place. We're going to provide wellness for those persons housed in our jail, because my goal is, ultimately, is that an individual who finds him or herself in the jail, that once they leave the jail after being before a judge or making bail, that they not return to that jail. And again, so we've got to help equip them with the tools that they can use so that when they get back out. So we've got a lot of things in mind how we can make that period in which they're in jail one where, again, we're helping them so that when they go back out, that they don't return again.
So there's going to be an emphasis on assisting in rehabilitation by the Sheriff's Department?
I would say that there's a focus there that was there at one point, was removed, and now I think it needs to return. I've already talked with a number of groups that have programs and opportunities that they can provide inmates for the period that they are in custody at the jail, and tools to help them that when they get out that they can reconnect with their families, reconnect with jobs and other opportunities, and more importantly, avoid those behaviors that found themselves winding up in our jail.
So does this mostly have to do with jail administration policy changes, or on the ground, how is it going to look?
It's a multifaceted approach. Again, our patrol efforts are one that we've got to patrol in communities and ensure that we're not just arresting individuals who, for whatever reason, diversion might be a better alternative to whatever problem that they may have. But then you're right. Once individuals come into custody at our jail, we've got to be able to provide a place where those individuals have opportunities so that when they get back out in the community, that they have the tools and are equipped to avoid returning to our jail.
And for a while, the Sheriff's Department was in charge of both the House of Correction and the Milwaukee Jail. Are you going to come up with any ideas based on what's happening at the House of Correction? Because I know they have like yoga programs, they have various programs of rehabilitation there. Is that something that the Milwaukee County Jail is going to try to work on?
Well, we're two separate entities, but I'm certainly looking forward to working with the folks out at the House of Correction. They have programs and practices in place that can help us. And if we have programs and practices in place that can help them, I'm about partnering so that we can learn from one another and provide better services in our facilities.
So do you think there will be a big change in environment in the Milwaukee County Jail?
I'm confident that with the leaders that we're bringing in place, as well as a renewed commitment to treating everyone with dignity and respect, as well as an opportunity for everybody to just do their jobs, not worry about looking over their backs, worrying about what's going to happen to them, but just focus on getting the job done. Yes, there's going to be a change in the culture and the attitude in the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office.
Finally, what is your position on whether or not the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Department will cooperate with ICE?
I had made clear that I am not going to honor those requests that come from ICE. I am even more convinced now that that does nothing but drive a wedge in our community. A request from ICE is just that, a request. If an individual is brought into my facility under local charges, and once he or she satisfies, either released by a magistrate and or a bail is posted, that individual is going to be released from my custody. We have no desire or intention to hold individuals, because by doing so, we also could be violating rights of an individual to an unlawful search and seizure. So again, we will not be honoring those requests.
Any other big changes that we should know about?
Well, I say look for us to be more in the community. Again, we talked about what the core roles and responsibilities of the sheriff's office is. But look for us to be more actively engaged in partnerships with other law enforcement agencies. Look for us to be engaged in more partnerships with the community. And certainly look for us to find more ways and better ways to make Milwaukee County strong and make Milwaukee County safe.
Ernell Lucas is the Milwaukee County Sheriff-elect. He succeeds Interim Sheriff Richard Schmidt, who filled out the term of longtime Sheriff David Clark. Lucas spoke with Lake Fex Mayon Silver.
Another longtime Wisconsin leader left office abruptly over the weekend. Packers head coach Mike McCarthy was fired following the team's loss on Sunday. We'll talk about what that means for the team in the games and years to come when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Packers' difficult season managed to get even worse over the weekend. Playing in perfect Lambeau Field weather, a cold and snowy Sunday, the Pack lost to the lowly Arizona Cardinals and all but ended their playoff hopes.
Following the loss, the Packers dismissed longtime head coach Mike McCarthy and replaced him on an interim basis with Joe Philbin. Sean Ranft is our sports contributor, and he joins us in the studio to talk about the rare coaching shakeup in Green Bay. Hi, Sean. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So it's interesting. We were just talking about this a little bit before we turned the microphones on. We're talking about the Mike McCarthy firing in ways that, with no disrespect intended, people talk about things like Pearl Harbor and the Kennedy assassination. Where were you when you heard that Mike McCarthy was fired? I was at a party. You were
walking home from the park.
But it is, as far as football fans in Wisconsin go, it is a fairly major announcement because coaches just don't come and go in Green Bay very often.
No, it's a huge deal. 13 years before that, I know the Mike Sherman era lasted a pretty long time as well. They had the Ray Rhodes one season in there, and that was it. But generally speaking, coaches in Green Bay last a while.
I was looking this up, and in the time since Mike McCarthy had been hired as head coach of the Green Bay Packers, the Milwaukee Bucks have had 8 head coaches, including their current head coach. Why is the position of head coach, at least in Green Bay, such a more stable position than in the NBA, where coaches are seemingly far more disposable?
I think with Green Bay, they've always had a similar structure, at least for the past 10 to 15 years, and even before that with Brett Favre being there. They have a very specific way of doing things. You know, up until the last couple of years, they didn't really dip into free agency that much. The way they operated was just a very straightforward level. They didn't, you know, fans always wanted to spend a lot of money, and they just know we're going to do it the same way. We're going to draft people. We're going to keep people. And they made the playoffs constantly. So if you're making the playoffs, even if some of the seasons were underwhelming or you didn't win the Super Bowl at the end, it's hard to justify firing a head coach. And based on wins and losses, Mike McCarthy leaves with a pretty glowing record. the last two seasons, you know, notwithstanding, obviously you can't take those out. But he didn't do a terrible job here. He did a pretty good job here, and eventually I think things just got stale.
Why did the Packers, do you think, decide that they needed to show him the door before the season ended this year?
I think it would have been a waste of everybody's time, including Mike McCarthy's, to keep him on for the rest of the season.
Would have been a lame duck coaching situation?
Yeah, and I know he had an extension, and I used air quotes there, where it had an option for next season. But he was essentially operating under a one-year contract, and things started to go a little sour. And yesterday was their season. Their season was probably already over before this. You know, they had the tough losses to Seattle and Minnesota, and that was probably it then. But you lose at home to the, at the time, 2-win Arizona Cardinals. You looked flat again for the third straight week, especially in the second half. Something had to be done. They're 4-7-1. I mean, they're not going anywhere. And you might as well get a head start on the rest of the league. There's going to be a lot of turnover. There's always a lot of turnover when it comes to the lesser teams. And it would have been a waste of everybody's time to keep him here. And I think he'll be better off. He's going to land somewhere, too. And yeah, they can just get a head start on seeing who they're going to bring in next.
Who are the names that are out there that you think are most intriguing to the Green Bay Packers organization?
I don't even know if it fits under most intriguing. It seems like the most obvious ones that I've seen, everyone wants Josh McDaniels because of his offensive mind. I don't know if I want Josh McDaniels. His head coaching record isn't stellar. He seems to operate very well within the Patriot system because obviously they know what they're doing in New England.
Appears to be the heir apparent to Bill Belichick.
And that's the other thing. He had the Colts job. He was just about to sign on to be their coach and decided, nah, I'd rather just stay in New England. You have to imagine there's a reason he stayed there. While it's going to be enticing for any unemployed head coach to have a few years of Aaron Rodgers left. I don't know if McDaniels is the guy. I don't think they need a super genius offensive mind. They just need a coach who can run a more modern offense. Their defense has been lacking for several years. And even if you can see some pieces in place with their defensive coordinator now, I would probably look towards a more defensive-minded coach. I don't know who that would be. The Harbaugh names are being thrown around. I saw an article this morning that said they should call, you know, Mike Shanahan, and I don't agree with that necessarily, but there are going to be tons of names out there. They might even look at coaches who get fired from their respective teams this season. I don't think they're even going to make an announcement at the end of the season. I think they'll go a little into the offseason without a decision. I can say almost for sure that Joe Philbin won't be the head coach next season.
It will be interesting for the last few games of this season to see those sideline shots and not see Mike McCarthy there with the headphones.
It's going to be strange. It'll just be interesting to see how also the rest of the team responds for the last four games. You always see that little boost when there's a coaching change, and we'll see if they come out, you know, blazing the next 4 weeks. It just, the team that played against Arizona on Sunday doesn't look like a team that is going to do anything the rest of the season.
We'll pick this conversation up come playoff time.
Yeah, maybe they'll have a couple interviews set up by then and a couple of names that are floating around.
All right. Sean Rampt, thanks.
Thank you.
Sean Rampt is the managing editor of the Sports Post and our regular sports contributor. You can find his past conversations on Lake Effect at WUWM.com.
One more break, and then we'll get into the spirit of the season with a unique twist on some Hanukkah music. That's when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
of Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. And this is the music of a group of Milwaukee musicians who came together to put a unique spin on the dreidel, or Hanukkah music anyway. Mitch Shiner plays vibes, Rick Aaron is on flute, Joey Sanchez plays bass, and Cecilio Negron Jr. is on the congas.
They call the project Latke Kun Salsa, and it will be part of the Hanukkah celebration Thursday evening at the Jewish Community Center in Whitefish Bay. They joined us for music and conversation in the Lake Effect Performance Studio, starting with this song called Sevivan Sav Sav Sav. Mitch Shiner on vibes, Rick Aaron on flute, Joey Sanchez on bass, and Celio Negron Jr. on the congas. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
That was fantastic. So we started, that was the first tune is Siv Ivan Sov Sov Sov. So first off, Mitch, where did the idea come from for Latke Kun Salsa?
It's kind of an unlikely mashup. Like, one of my favorite styles of music is Latin jazz, and that's really a fusion of many different styles all at once. And being more than somewhat interested in my own cultural identity, I wanted to figure out a way to make a fusion of the two things that I really enjoy, which is traditional Jewish tunes. I'm into those and figuring out where they come from and why we sort of sing the ones that we do today, and also the amazing rhythms that come from the Caribbean and South America, and trying to make that all together.
True.
Let's also remember both cultures love high-fat cholesterol foods.
Yes.
We have noticed this.
Right. But, you know, was there a precedence for you to base this stuff off of, or were you just going to work like, I like these traditional Jewish songs for Hanukkah, and I love these Latin jazz songs, and then did you see which ones naturally fit together, or what was your process for it? Because I imagine no one's quite done this before.
Yeah, I've done a little bit of research into this kind of project, and this is pretty unique.
Is it fair to say no Milwaukee people have ever heard this fusion?
My guess is this hasn't been heard anywhere.
Yeah.
Seriously. Yeah.
You may be the first, Mitch.
This is crazy. A lot of the recorded Jewish songs, in my opinion, are lacking in like the rhythmic diversity and rhythmic
soul.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. So I wanted to try to bring a little bit of that into the mix.
I'm going to say it a little more simplistically. These right. Hanukkah yeah. tunes have never had it this good before.
Well, based on that
Thanks,
first
Rick.
Example.
Thank you, Rick.
There has been some groups in the past that have done a mix of traditional songs like Osei Shalom with a Wawanko rhythm with a different. I can't remember exactly who they are off the top of my head, but there are things, and the culture's been around our culture since when salsa was born. Actually, just to talk a little bit about it, one of the main composers, movers in Fania. Back in the 60s.
Fania Records,
back in the 60s, 50s and 60s, was Larry Harlow, who I believe, if not my mistaken, is Jewish. And one of the owners of Fania as well is Jewish. The record industry also, during that time, was also ran a lot by a lot of Jewish people, businessmen, who gave opportunities to a lot of Latin musicians, and that's where Fania came out of in New York City, things like that. So there's definitely been a mix before, but what you're doing here is not. I haven't heard it before. So.
Yeah, and well, Jody, when Mitch came to you for this idea, you know, did it, you know, was it exciting for you? Because I imagine the JCC has a bit more traditional Hanukkah programming typically, but what were your thoughts going through to bring this to the people of the JCC?
Well, I really wanted a jazz concert of some sort that we would do during Hanukkah. This is actually during the actual holiday of Hanukkah, which lasts 8 days. I didn't think necessarily of the Latin thing, but then Mitch said, well, let's do this Latin thing. And I thought it was amazing. And we kind of kicked along different names. And really, Mitch came up with the name, you know, Latke. Latke is a potato pancake, of course, which is traditionally served on Hanukkah. And he said, how about Latke con salsa? And I thought, wow, that's great. And so not only is the music this, but we designed the menu because of the name of this,
right.
this concert.
Mm-hmm.
Big melting pot of a lot of different things for the Hanukkah celebration.
Right, exactly. And of course, eating is like really critical. Yes. With holiday celebrations as it is in the Latin culture also.
Not much different than Puerto Rican or Cuban or any Caribbean Latin culture.
Right.
For mm-hmm.
Sure. Yeah. Any, sure.
We'd like to eat, especially right. a lot of high fat.
Yeah, so, you know, we have you, Mitch, and Rick, you are both Jewish. And for you, Joy and Cecilio, you know, coming from different cultural backgrounds, invited to play this mashup of sorts, you know, you have one strength probably in the Latin jazz area, but didn't know much about the songs of Hanukkah and what it means. So what did all of you learn in this process of melding these two together?
I would say in music, anything is possible because I never heard any of these tunes before. And see Mitch, you know, bringing all these shards. And at the beginning it was, you know, kind of crazy just to digest it. But when you see the final result with all these musicians, they are so amazing. The product is really good. I know people are going to enjoy this, definitely.
For sure.
And actually, it's an international language. I mean, that's the most wonderful thing about music is you don't even have to speak the same language, right. but you can play music together.
Right, it's you can play fantastic. Music together and vibe together on these tunes. You know, they're all conveying a message of happiness and coming together to celebrate a holiday.
And the struggle of the music in which the music came from is the same as well, too. Like, a lot of traditional music, from the Jewish music, came out of a really serious struggle throughout history.
Right.
And so did the traditional rhythms out of the Caribbean, came out of the struggle during the times of slavery, during the times of oppression.
Right.
So those things will always kind of gravitate back to each other no matter what and kind of work well together and taste good.
Yeah. Well, let's get another sampling of this tasting. Mitch, you might have to jump in on the pronunciation of this, but our second to
Mao Tsur Mozambique.
Thank you. Again, that was Mitch Shiner on vibes, Rick Aaron on flute, Joey Sanchez on bass, and Cecilio Negron Jr. on the congas. With a little taste of what's to come for the Latka con Salsa concert at the JCC. So, Mitch, what are the typical instrumentations for these classic Jewish Hanukkah songs? And was it easy in your mind to, or anyone can take this, was it easy in your mind to pair it with flute, vibes, you know, all these different ways you could have interpreted jazz?
Yeah, Rick can explain a little bit more.
Traditional klezmer music probably would have a clarinet with a rhythm section. The harmony is far more defined in traditional klezmer music. What Mitch has done is really stretched this and used pretty much American harmonic jazz sensibilities in mashing the two cultures together.
Now, you mentioned before that Hanukkah music has never had it this good. So when you were first rehearsing this, you know, were you thinking, oh, gosh, why haven't we done this before? Or, you know, why can't we liven up all the Hanukkah music or reinterpret?
Well, and again, and I'm not a scholar about Hanukkah music. I'm not a scholar about Jewish music. But Hanukkah music is pretty square. They're really child songs. Jody, perhaps, you know, I'm sure you know a whole lot more than I do. But, you know, people right away think about the dreidel song. Well, if I never heard the dreidel song again, it would be fine.
Well, I think a lot of it was children's songs. Some of it is folk songs, but it always had kind of like a very sort of calm folk song quality to it, you know? I mean, to put these kind of wild beats is like, who would have thought of such a thing? I think it really, it really enlivens these songs in a ways that we don't usually think of.
Well, and for all of you, for Mitch and for you, Rick, knowing these tunes, growing up with them, celebrating them, and now, I suppose, relearning them in a way, and you guys coming to this, perhaps knowing a bit more with the Latin jazz background, knowing those beats and integrating this new song, what did you all learn or what were your favorite components of bringing these two cultures together musically?
There's not much, what did I learn? There's not much differences between the cultures, really. It's just reaffirmed all of that, you know?
Right.
For me, that's what.
One thing I was going to say, I'm very proud of this kind of thing. I mean, at the Jewish Community Center, we have an initiative that we call Tapestry, which is arts and ideas. And so the arts are just the most powerful way to convey culture. And this fusion of Jewish and Latin culture is exactly what I think that we should be doing, because you just absorb it. I don't have to lecture about it. You know, it's just there. And it's a very wonderful thing. And I'm so proud that we could do this at the Jewish Community Center.
I think, too, I mean, especially given some of the events of late, I think it's important for communities who are feeling
vulnerable
and having
disenfranchised.
Yeah. For those communities to come together and really celebrate the positive things about our cultures, because we all know that that's really the things that ring true for us.
Yeah.
You guys have anything to add, or?
Well, it's interesting listening to this conversation. Musicians, especially musicians who improvise, I don't care if they come from Puerto Rico or Haiti or the Dominican Republic or the United States, we are constantly trying to alter the printed note harmonically, rhythmically.
What if?
Yeah.
And still we have honor or we respect the roots of where it's coming from, then that's the most important thing. I'm talking about, in my case, like I'm Puerto Rican, and we have this music from Puerto Rico that is really, really unique. In the past couple of years, we've been trying to add, and some people get like extra crispy about it. How you gonna do that with that tune? But we gotta explore. We gotta explore, see the possibilities, but we always respect the roots, and we honor the roots where this is coming from, and we always, doesn't matter how or what you add to it, the message is going to be the same and the root is going to be there. People are going to recognize the song. For me, that's the most important. It's going to be fun.
Oh, I'm excited.
Well, as Rick said, even though you're looking to see what you can change, you guys are also following each other's lead and respecting each other's voices and instruments. So, you know, that was so present here today, and I want to thank you all so much for coming, sharing your time and your talents, and I can't wait to hear what everyone thinks of this.
Yeah, thank you so much, Audrey.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, what
do
we close out with?
Gracias.
We are going to close with Hanukkah, O Hanukkah.
Thank you.
Hanukkah, Oh Hanukkah, performed by Mitch Shiner on vibes, Rick Aaron on flute, Joey Sanchez on bass, and Cecilio Negron Jr. on the congas. They'll all play along with percussionist Dave Bayless at Latka Con Salsa at the JCC in Whitefish Bay on Thursday evening. They were joined by the JCC's Judaic Education Director Jody Hirsch. Jason Reavy engineered the performance, and you can find full versions of all of the songs they played and read more at WUWM.com. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Like Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.